From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, touring nuclear test sites, labs, and missile silos. Defense industry reporters Nathan Hodge and Sharon Weinberger traveled to 10 states and 5 countries, including Iran and Kazakhstan. The trip was part Cold War time capsule, but it was also about the role nuclear weaponry still plays in today's world. Hodge and Weinberger are married. Their new book is called A Nuclear Family Vacation: Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews a new exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, celebrating two generations of the Hank Williams family. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the fall of the Soviet Union, the Cold War ended, and the threat of nuclear war faded. But when weapons industry reporters Sharon Weinberger and Nathan Hodge toured nuclear sites across the United States, they found the nuclear industry still operating with new weapons being planned and bombs standing ready on hair trigger alert. Weinberger and Hodge are married. They took a series of trips navigating through the little-known world of nuclear tourism and using their press credentials when necessary, visiting former nuclear bomb test sites, decommissioned bunkers, missile silos, labs, and museums devoted to the history of nuclear weapons. Their new book is called A Nuclear Family Vacation: Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. They visited sites in 10 states and 5 countries, including Iran. Sharon Weinberger previously joined us to discuss her book, Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon's Scientific Underworld. Nathan Hodge writes for Jane's Defense Weekly. Sharon Weinberger, Nathan Hodge, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with your trip to Nevada. What is Nevada's special place in the history of nuclear weapons testing?
Well, the Nevada test site, which is reasonably close to Las Vegas, is where during the Cold War, we conducted nuclear tests for a while above ground and then later underground as there were treaty limitations. And, you know, these went on up through basically the end of the Cold War. And it kind of had this weird parallel existence to Las Vegas, you know, the city of sin and casinos and gambling. And the test site, although this was, you know, secretive work in a way, in the days of above ground testing, when you had these sort of magnificent mushroom clouds, it was, you know, as we described it, it was a picnicker's delight. People would watch it. It had sort of an entertainment value. It became part of this kitschy culture of Las Vegas. You can now go on bus tours. They organize once a month bus tours, and I'm told is, you know, very popular with retirees, visitors to Las Vegas, and you can visit, you can see the remains of the above ground tests, you know, sort of twisted metal. You can see these huge craters left by the underground tests. And so it still fits into this sort of weird Las Vegas existence.
So there really is nuclear tourism now.
There really is nuclear tourism that, in fact, is encouraged. It's organized by the National Nuclear Security Administration. This is the sort of the agency that oversees our nuclear complex. And they organize monthly bus tours of Nevada, as well of the nuclear laboratories. And this serves a goal. It is to increase public support for the nuclear infrastructure, for the labs. You know, they say it has educational value, and that's certainly true. But nuclear weapons are no longer regarded as once needed as they once were. So the desire to have public support for this infrastructure, you know, is for these agencies very needed.
When you toured Nevada test sites, you not only saw, you know, craters and such from bombs that were exploded, you saw some evidence of other kinds of testing that was done during the bomb explosions. For example, there was testing on pigs. What kind of testing was done on pigs, and what are the remains of those tests?
Yes. Well, pig skin, it turns out, is reasonably close for testing purposes to human skin. And so pigs were, but for better or worse, sort of a popular sort of stand-in for humans. And so you get this sense of both the bizarreness of nuclear testing and also the types of things that they were looking at or they were concerned about, you know, that they testing on everything. Okay, how would human skin do? How would, you know, a suburban house do? How would cars do? What would happen to radio stations? This sort of recreating of American life in this sort of miniature models. They really did rebuild sort of little mini towns, survival cities, to test the effects on the infrastructure.
Is there any, like, post-nuclear survival town remains? Like, do you see the effects that the bomb had on these little fake towns?
But what's, I think, most visually impressive, definitely, the Nevada test site, is they had put a Mosler bank vault right on the desert floor, and it had just been part of the concrete and rebar been stripped clean by the atomic blast. It's pretty impressive.
Is there any testing being done in Nevada now?
Yes, they do a number of different tests, ranging from sort of homeland security, some things that they don't talk about, you know, chem bio testing for Department of Homeland Security, for Department of Defense. In terms of nuclear weapons, what they do are what are called subcritical tests on plutonium. How does plutonium, the trigger for a thermonuclear weapon, respond to sort of being blasted or pounded upon? Because we need to know how these triggers age, how the different component parts of nuclear weapons age. These are done underground. They're announced ahead of time. And one of the ongoing political issues under the current administration is they want to be ready, if need be, to resume nuclear testing. And this is, of course, one of the most controversial issues at the Nevada test site, because the Bush administration wanted to speed up. Basically, you know, how long does it take if the president decided today that we need to test nuclear weapons again? How long does it take us to get to that point? Does it take 36 months, 12 months? And there's a lot of arguments about this. But the whole idea of being able to speed up that process triggered a political debate in Congress. There was a compromise. And so we've speeded up a little, as a way to put it.
You also went to New Mexico to look at test sites there. You went to the White Sands Missile Range. What was tested there, and what are the remains of the tests?
White Sands Missile Range is where the Trinity Atomic Test Site is located. It was where the first atomic device was tested in 1945. And it's one of the more fascinating places to visit. And interestingly enough, it's open, I think, twice a year still for public tours. The thing that's most impressive, perhaps, is the crater, which is still visible, which was burned into the desert floor. And you can still wander around the original Ground Zero and still hunt for pieces of trinitite. This is this sort of very ghostly bluish-green glass that was created by the heat of the blast.
It created glass out of the sand?
Yes, right. It created this eerie-looking glass out of the sand. And for years and years, pieces of trinitite just sort of disappeared into the pockets of tourists until a few years ago, when they decided they needed to preserve some larger chunk of trinitite still on the desert floor. And they've kind of fenced it off a little bit. But you can still wander around and find these sort of little pebble-sized pieces of trinitite. Now, of course, our guide said, oh, well, you know, you'd have to really eat your weight in trinitite. It's still slightly radioactive, but, you know, no big deal.
How concerned were you on this nuclear tour that you would come in contact with radiation?
You know, you don't think about it at the time. And I think this is maybe a product of our age and the time we grew up in. The concerns about radiation from nuclear testing were really sort of before our time. And so, you know, what was told to us at the Trinity site was literally someone said, we're the government, we wouldn't let you in, you know, if this were dangerous, which is sort of a bad joke if you think about it, considering how cavalier over the years of testing the U.S. government was, both with its own citizens and citizens of other countries, about safety and health related to radiation. You know, I mean, speaking to scientists who are familiar with this work, I do take it at face value that the Trinity site, where you just had that one nuclear explosion, you know, they say it's at background levels. I'm willing to take that at face value. There are parts of the Nevada test site that apparently they will not take people to for radiation reasons. It was really in Kazakhstan at the old Soviet test site where we actually had a guide with us who was measuring radiation and was, you know, warning us, you know, wash your hands, wash your clothing. And, you know, he was measuring the radiation as we went through, and we got to Ground Zero, that thing spiked up. And it was really the first time that you sort of took it seriously, because they were telling, you know, don't touch things, don't lay down on the ground, don't sit down. And part of this may be phobia that so little was told to citizens in Kazakhstan at the time about what was going on, that a good, healthy and deserved paranoia extends to today. And there's a second issue, which is they did their testing differently. You know, they would explode, you know, bomb after bomb after bomb in one place at the test site, at the Semipalatinsk test site in Kazakhstan. But we got back and, you know, I don't know that we thoroughly doused everything, but we really did think about it.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Nathan Hodge and Sharon Weinberger, the authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Energy. And they went to 5 countries and 10 U.S. states, touring nuclear labs, nuclear weapons facilities, old nuclear test sites. They're both journalists who write about defense. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guests are Sharon Weinberger and Nathan Hodge. They're the authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. And they toured 5 countries and 10 states in the United States looking at nuclear test sites and other nuclear facilities. Nathan Hodge is a writer for Jane's Defense Weekly. Sharon Weinberger is a contributing writer for Wired's national security blog, Danger Room. On your visits, you went to a few nuclear research labs, and you learned about, you know, weapons in the works, weapons that had been in the works and were taken out of development. One of the weapons that you learned about was known by the acronym SADM, S-A-D-M, which stood for Special Atomic Demolition Munition. It would have been one of the smallest nuclear weapons in the arsenal, so small it would be strapped to a commando. Would that have made the commando who used this weapon a nuclear suicide bomber?
In short, yes. I think, in fact, we have a quote in the book from one of the former SADM mission-trained members who said it was suicide and we all knew it. The idea was that you would, you know, a commando would strap this thing to his back, parachute into enemy territory, presumably evade capture or detection, get to the destination, let's say, you know, a dam, some other strategic site, a bridge, and then stand maybe 100 meters, a couple hundred meters away and detonate this thing. And if you think about it, what really made these kinds of weapons obsolete was the advent of precision and weaponry. We don't need this kind of device anymore. If we want to blow up a bridge, we can drop a couple of satellite-guided bombs on the supports and very neatly destroy it. But these things were invented in the days before the advent of, you know, what we call sort of modern precision and weaponry. So it does raise, you know, questions for us. What were all of these things for? And would they even have any kind of application today?
There's just one thing I wanted to add, which is the realization that we got out of our trips of how many jobs in the nuclear world were suicide missions. I mean, if you look at it, even sort of the B-2 bomber, the bombers that were going to go drop their weapons on the Soviet Union were never really expected to come back. The missileers who sit underground waiting to turn the key to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles, they were targets. And it was expected that was a suicide mission. I mean, just as there were for the commandos with the nuke on their back, there were sort of instructions on what to do afterwards. You know, for the guys underground, they were going to walk 200 miles through radioactive ruins and report to their recruiting stations. But it was twisted. And yet some of these missions still exist today.
Well, what about that weapon we were talking about, that special atomic demolition munition, which a commando would strap to his back? How far did that get?
How far did it get in terms of
its... In terms of officially entering the arsenal?
Oh, no, it was in the arsenal. It was in service for a couple of decades, actually. And the warhead that was designed for it was packaged in different ways. You could put it in this canister, the SADM canister, which looks kind of like a garbage can, and a commando could deliver it. It could also be packaged, I think, on a recoilless rifle or one version of a similar sort of warhead. Again, a device with not a very long range. And if you think about it, it was a very large part of the nuclear mission. It's been taken out of the arsenal now, but this was the tactical nuke, and it was part of atomic plans for nuclear war fighting.
So now that that little bomb that would have been strapped to the back of commandos is no longer part of the arsenal, what happened to the bombs, the SADM bombs that existed? Have they been decommissioned? Are they still around?
Well, one of the places that we went to was Y-12 in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is in the business of, and a lot of the what had been part of the nuclear weapons production complex turned to the task of dismantlement. And as these weapons were taken out of the inventory, they basically sent them back to the factory, and they told the people who had been working on building the bombs for years and years, well, your job now is to unscrew these things, take them apart, and then we're going to dispose of the fissile material. And, you know, it's very interesting talking to people who had spent, you know, the better part of their careers during the Cold War, sort of in, you know, the equivalent of, you know, it's like a car factory. But at the end, these cars are obsolete. Now they're being told your main job here is not to build new cars. It's to dismantle the ones you built for all those decades.
In your visits to nuclear labs, did you learn about new nuclear weapons in development?
Yes, one of the main things that was going on that we spoke to people about was there have been a couple proposals over the past number of years to revive designing nuclear weapons, producing nuclear weapons. The one with the most currency right now is the reliable replacement warhead. And, you know, they always say, don't call it a new warhead, don't call it a new warhead, but then you run out of adjectives to describe it. It is... I guess it's a new warhead. And the idea is that as you have an aging nuclear arsenal, you know, we haven't produced a new nuclear weapon, designed a new nuclear weapon in, you know, well over a decade. And so the idea is that you would build a new nuclear weapon that is more reliable, that is safer, you know, can't be tampered with if it was, you know, taken by terrorists. And that is one controversial proposal, very controversial, because a lot of people don't want to see nuclear weapons production again. A lot of scientists are questioning whether, you know, the aging arsenal is fine. Why start again? The other one that was proposed was what's called the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, RNEP, also sort of called a nuclear bunker buster. This would be a nuclear weapon specifically designed to penetrate underground, to take out bunkers, you know, bunkers, you know, that have, you know, leaders in them, you know, the head of North Korea or Iraq or Iran or wherever, or to take out stores of WMD that may be stored underground. And so these are the two proposals we talked about with people at the labs.
So are the two nuclear weapons that you talked about in the works, or are they on hold now because of the controversy surrounding them?
Well, it looks like at present, something like the reliable replacement warhead was stalled. Congress stepped in essentially to block funding. The same thing goes for the RNEP, the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator. But one thing that we noticed is that these weapons projects never really die. They get revived in some form or another, even though we could look at some of the spending bills and we could say with some confidence that, well, it looks like the funding line for that has been zeroed out for the next year. These are projects that in many ways have emanated from the labs. They're a way to, number one, kind of maintain and attract scientific talent, because you want to bring people into the lab. They're attracted to the idea of designing something new. Again, you know, they always try to avoid using the word new when they're describing the reliable replacement warhead. They say, oh, we're just repackaging, you know, a weapons design that was proven out in the late 1980s. But that being said, there's some attraction, I think, to the scientists that we spoke to the idea of, well, we're not going to be in maintenance work. We'll be designing something new. This is, you know, quite exciting. I think this is what really brought people to the labs in the era of the Cold War.
You write in your book that visiting intercontinental ballistic missile sites is a great way to tour the Great Northern Plains. Are these ICBM sites still active? Do they still have ICBMs there? Are they on alert?
Well, this is the interesting thing. This kind of shows how much sort of nuclear issues had receded to the background in debates about national security. We've both been covering the Defense Department and the military for you know, the better part of a decade. But I think that before we started, if you had asked us, are nukes still on alert? Are they still active? You know, I probably would have had to go look it up. And what we discover, of course, on our trip is that these weapons still are on hair trigger alert. There still are missileer crews underground in the Great Plains pulling missile alert duty. And we went to an active missile alert facility based out of Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. Actually went underground into the capsule, talked to an active crew. And one of the things that we really wanted to ask them about, well, you know, with the Cold War over and our traditional idea of deterrence gone, well, what exactly is it that you're doing down here? And it was pretty interesting to watch them kind of grope a little bit for answers on that.
Yeah, well, what did they have to say?
Well, interestingly enough, they said, kind of fell back on an answer that we heard a lot when we were traveling through the nuclear complex. The world is still a dangerous place. You know, look at 9/11. But without taking it any further and saying, well, how does the nuclear deterrent prevent a 9/11? Do you use nuclear weapons as a reprisal tool in the event of another 9/11? You know, how do you use nuclear weapons to deter, for instance, a suicide bomber who's committed to die? You know, it's very interesting talking to people who work on sort of the operational end of the nuclear mission. And what we've seen in recent weeks is a tremendous shakeup in the top leadership of the Air Force precisely over this kind of, we call it like a lack of focus or a lack of real attention to the nuclear mission. There were a couple of really, really serious incidents in the handling and accounting for nuclear weapons. One was some nuclear-armed cruise missiles that were mistakenly loaded on a B-52 bomber and flown across the country. They went unaccounted for several hours until someone discovered the error. There have been other sorts of lapses of discipline because the missileer's job is a very tedious one. It's a one of procedures and checklists. And it was always that way. It was always, I think, in the Cold War, it was considered a very important, vital, and prestigious career track. Once you find that your mission has become less relevant, how do you attract the most motivated, the most talented? How do you maintain those kinds of high standards? And this is something that, the Air Force is still wrestling with today.
Nathan Hodge and Sharon Weinberger are the authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. From Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from Hear Music, presenting the new James Hunter CD, The Hard Way, with 12 new and original tracks, including Don't Do Me No Favors, available at Borders. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the nuclear family vacation moves on to nuclear sites in Iran and Kazakhstan as we continue our conversation with Sharon Weinberger and Nathan Hodge. And Myla Miles visits an exhibit celebrating Hank Williams and his family at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with defense reporters Nathan Hodge and Sharon Weinberger, authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. They went to 10 American states and 5 countries, touring nuclear test sites, research labs, missile silos, decommissioned bunkers, and museums devoted to atomic weapons. One of the book's conclusions is that the U.S. does not have a coherent nuclear strategy for dealing with the threats that face the country today.
I think we started off believing that nuclear weapons were a legitimate part of our defense strategy. There's a legitimate role for nuclear deterrence, and that, you know, maybe we need these things on hair trigger alert. And I think with each visit we made, we became a bit sort of chipped away and became a bit more disillusioned. You know, of course the nuclear labs want to build new nuclear weapons. That's what they're trained to do, and it's hard to blame them for that. But it is the job of the government, of senior civilian leaders, to define that strategy and say, no, we don't need new nuclear weapons, or we do. It just seems like everything's reactive. And at the end of the day, the ultimate absurdity is, you know, you have all these weapons on hair trigger alert, which is for one purpose. It's not against terrorism. It's not for China or for North Korea or Iran, because those countries don't have a hair trigger alert. It's for Russia, which has a hair trigger alert. And we don't have the adversarial, we may have problems with Russia, but certainly not to the extent that we had with the Soviet Union. And so all of this infrastructure is supporting a threat that shouldn't really exist. And that, to me, just, I think it struck us as absurd, and it really chipped away at our belief in the legitimacy of nuclear deterrence and of our nuclear strategy.
In your tour of nuclear facilities in the United States, you went to what you assume is the underground bunker that Vice President Cheney and other people went to after 9/11. It's called Site R. It's in Pennsylvania, just across the Maryland border. What is Site R?
Site R is otherwise known as the Underground Pentagon. It's a bunker not very far. It's a driving distance in Washington. And it's part of this larger continuity of government scheme. Now, we did get the chance to go to some of the actual active bunkers, like Cheyenne Mountain, which is moving in the direction of going on standby. And we went to a decommissioned bunker, which is underneath the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. Site R, well, the closest we got to it was we got to hang around the outside gate. Of all the places that we tried to visit, that was where we were sort of stonewalled the most. Site R is still used, I think, as a facility where, you know, Pentagon bureaucrats will occasionally go, and they'll pull a shift inside of this this underground bunker, just in the event that, you know, Armageddon happens.
One of the places you went to is Iran. What were the authorities in Iran willing to show you, and why did they show it to you?
We went to Iran with eyes open, knowing that we would only be shown exactly what the authorities wanted us to see. We had been trying for some time to go, and I had tried twice unsuccessfully to get a visa to go to Iran. But we got a call basically saying that they were going to be organizing an excursion for the press to the Isfahan Uranium Conversion Facility, which is what creates we call yellow cake, milled uranium oxide. It's the feedstock for uranium enrichment. And the purpose of this trip, in the eyes of the Iranian authorities, was to prove to the outside world the country's peaceful nuclear intentions, that this is, you know, strictly for atomic energy, that this is a matter of national pride. And as you enter sort of one of the conference halls of the uranium conversion facility, there's a giant photograph which was taken on the outside of the facility with the staff standing in their sort of white lab coats. And the slogan underneath the photo, I think both in Farsi and English, was, "Nuclear energy is our obvious right." So they had invited the international press as well as some non-aligned diplomats to go. In journalism terms, it's called a dog and pony show. It was sort of a photo opportunity inside of this uranium conversion facility. And they wanted to show things like the International Atomic Energy Agency's surveillance cameras inside of the facility. Show everything here is open. Everything is, our doors are open. We have absolutely nothing to hide. But in the course of this press visit, reporters were able to ask the question, well, if everything here is so open, why don't you take us to Natanz? And Natanz is really kind of the center of questions about Iran's nuclear aspirations. It's the enrichment facility that's north of Isfahan. And of course, the answer we got was, well, your request will be passed to the proper authorities. And it was left at that. And there was no invitation to go to Natanz.
One of the things you write about is looking at the facilities that you were shown in Iran made you think about the difficulty of airstrikes against any of them? And what would the difficulty be?
You know, first of all, Iran's nuclear facilities, as was pointed out to us with no small measure of pride, are widely distributed throughout the country. And, you know, it's not just the uranium conversion facility or Natanz or any of these other places, but it was hinted to us that, well, you know, we've widely dispersed both our know-how and our capabilities. But we were also taken on this tour of Isfahan after our tour of this sort of industrial facility. They took us for a lovely excursion through historic Isfahan, which is a gorgeous city, marvelous tourist destination. And the subtext of this tour around Isfahan is, you know, if there are airstrikes, it's going to be dangerously close to a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
And is it that way around several of the nuclear facilities, that they're close to important, like civilian or international facilities or buildings, and there would be, you know, like really bad collateral damage if you tried to take out one of the nuclear facilities?
That's the argument they make. One of the think tankers we spoke with, an Iranian think tanker, basically said that, you know, look at, you know, you'll be bombing cities, you'll be bombing civilian areas, heritage sites. You know, a more cynical argument might say, well, some of these places were put in proximity to these sites exactly for that purpose. But, you know, welcome to the world of current nuclear strategy. You know, you disperse your facilities, you put them near civilian sites, you do anything you can to make them less vulnerable to airstrikes because, you know, this is certainly a big threat for them. And I think even you'll find people in the U.S. who will say the same thing. If you bomb them, yeah, you're going to set them back a few more years, but ultimately they can rebuild and they can retain the know-how. And the other argument is, well, that we got there was, if you do bomb us, well, then any sort of pretension to adhering to the nonproliferation treaty, you know, all that might have to be looked at again. You know, why would we let inspectors in? So it is, you know, that's a delicate balance, and they have their arguments. And I guess the question is, are you willing to bomb any country and bomb it every few years to keep nuclear know-how out of their hands? Is this a good long-term strategy? I'm not so sure.
Well, recently, Israel's transportation minister, Shaul Mofaz, warned that an Israeli attack on Iranian nuclear sites would be, quote, unavoidable if they proceed with their nuclear weapons program. Do you have any sense of what the Israeli strategy might be if it did decide to launch airstrikes against Iran's nuclear program?
Well, we can look to some historical precedents. I mean, there was the strike against the Oserac reactor in Iraq in the early 1980s. More recently, there have been questions about a very interesting Israeli-led airstrike last summer against a site in Syria that, again, has been in intelligence released to the public, tagged as also a nuclear weapons site, or as a nuclear weapons site under construction. And again, there's sort of a lot of mystery surrounding what exactly happened and how this all exactly occurred. But it definitely does seem to be an option.
What reactions were you getting in Iran to the possibility of either an American or an Israeli airstrike against nuclear facilities? Was that a fear that you sensed government officials or citizens have?
At the time, I think that it was definitely a subject of public discussion. Many of the people we spoke to, you know, Iranian legislators, members of Iranian think tanks, responded to our questions about, well, what do you think about the possibility of some kind of airstrike, with their own question, well, what do you think would happen in the region were there to be a strike by Israel or the United States? In other words, some kind of implied retaliation.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Nathan Hodge and Sharon Weinberger, the authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Energy. And they went to 5 countries and 10 U.S. states, touring nuclear labs, nuclear weapons facilities, old nuclear test sites. They're both journalists who write about defense. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
My guests are defense industry reporters Sharon Weinberger and Nathan Hodge, authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. They toured nuclear weapon sites in 10 American states and 5 countries. One of the places you went to was Kazakhstan. Why did you choose Kazakhstan?
Kazakhstan is really kind of the parallel of Nevada in a lot of ways. It was one of the two main test sites for the Soviet Union. And it was also, this is an interesting part of the narrative, it was one of the countries that is a model for nuclear disarmament. When Kazakhstan sort of reluctantly came into existence in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this brand new country was in possession of a not insignificant nuclear arsenal. And it's a very interesting story of how a country basically made the decision to part with nuclear weaponry. Now, there are some questions about, well, whose control were they really under? And was there ever really that kind of breakdown? Did they have the potential to actually take operational control of those nukes? But they've had a very fraught relationship with the bomb. They were the main test site for the Soviets, and the Soviets didn't really do a very good job of keeping the citizenry informed about what was going on.
So in that sense, people of Kazakhstan see themselves as victims of nuclear testing, of Soviet nuclear testing.
And this is the big conflict. I mean, they want to attract tourists to Kazakhstan, and Kazakhstan's nuclear heritage is part of that. So how do you play up your victimhood? It's not a very attractive thing that they've done, trying to get people to visit some of the more grotesque things like they have in one of their museums, which is kind of this medical museum of horrors, sort of deformed fetuses in jars and things like that. And they showed it to us, and I just thought, this is the most gruesome kind of tourism ever. But what they're trying to do is simultaneously play up their role of nuclear victim and also as the nation that peacefully disarmed.
Your tour of Kazakhstan coincided with the opening publicity for the movie Borat. Could you see the impact of that in Kazakhstan when you were there?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of frustration because, you know, with revenues, you know, sort of oil, gas revenues coming in, you know, Kazakhstan is developing. It wants to show itself as a modernized country between East and West. The president has put sort of a lot of, you know, he put in advertising into this, and they, you know, wanted to have this sort of grand entrance in the United States and to be recognized and known in the Western world, particularly in the United States. And suddenly, the everything that every American associates with Kazakhstan is Borat. And, you know, for Sacha Baron Cohen, it was a good joke. It was a convenient joke because most people hadn't heard of Kazakhstan, but that was precisely the problem. Suddenly everyone had heard of it as, you know, the backwards horse urine drinking country that sold daughters into prostitution. And so they were desperate to, you know, combat this image, to show themselves as developed. And in some ways they do it well, but in some ways they almost play into the skit because there are elements of this old sort of the old Soviet Union left in some of their regional bureaucracies and municipalities. And in this contradiction between sort of nuclear victimhood and nuclear disarmament, this is not the, you know, a modern developed democratic country. It has elements of authoritarianism and sort of, you know, the worship of the president. So as much as they tried to combat it, in some ways they were playing into it.
Let's get back to the United States and what you learned on your tour of nuclear facilities in the United States. This is just a kind of general question. How many weapons do we have here, nuclear weapons do we have here now? Like, what's the extent of our nuclear arsenal?
Over the last few years, I forget precisely when, that's actually a lot harder to answer. It used to be a very precise number, and nuclear watchers would track this and the government would confirm it. A couple of years ago, the precise number of deployed weapons is classified. So you have to rely on estimates that I believe are around the 5,000-6,000 level. And the part of the problem is it is changing every day because we are in the process of getting down to what is the current negotiated limit with Russia, which is between 1,700 and 2,200 weapons. This is both what Russia and the United States have committed to. We're certainly a few thousand above that, getting down. The precise number is unknown. The one second element of that is that we're not always destroying those older weapons. There are non-deployed weapons being kept in storage, and that is another problem that some people are objecting to.
I want to thank you both for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Sharon Weinberger and Nathan Hodge are the authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. While in Nashville recently, music critic Milo Miles went to an exhibit about Hank Williams at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum called Family Tradition, the Williams Family Legacy, and culled mostly from the family's own collection, the exhibit features photos, documents, stage costumes, musical instruments, and new interviews with two generations of the Williams family.
One fine achievement of the Family Tradition Show at the Country Music Hall of Fame is that the exhibit escapes its rather pat official narrative. Co-curator and museum director Kyle Young's description of the exhibit presents the Williamses as more or less the Kennedys of country music. Young writes, "These are ordinary lives made extraordinary by an alignment of talent and bedrock values, and by the quest for personal and professional identity that continue to move each generation through the earthly joy and sorrow of the times they live in." In fact, it tells a stranger story, how a musical genius came out of nowhere and gave his family an enduring identity, even as he haunts them. The Family Tradition exhibit powerfully underscores how in 6 short years, Hank Williams Sr. went from promising newcomer to superstar to corpse, and how he became bigger after death than he ever was in life. By now, Hank Sr. has become the incarnation of pure country music.
At a man is getting kind of mad. I had lots of luck, but it's all been bad. No matter how I struggle and strive, I'll never get out of this world alive. My fishing pole's broke, the creek is full of sand. My woman run away with another man. No matter how I struggle and strive, I'll never get out of this world alive.
After Williams' death, his widow Audrey became an ambitious caretaker of his legacy. Hank Williams Jr. took the key step to make music the family tradition. He started performing on stage at age 8, and by 14 he was making records. After all, he was wearing sparkly stage cowboy suits when he was a tiny tyke. Although it took 2 decades, Hank Williams Jr. also went through striking changes of image. From a kind of impersonator of his father to an innovative embracer of rock to a kind of professional redneck. Unlike his dad, he's also become a darling of the music industry with a fat case full of awards and trophies. Since Junior's own celebration of his father's legacy has often been rote and self-serving, it was a welcome surprise to see how different he was from his yee-haw Bocephus persona in his video interviews. Here was an articulate, introspective fellow talking about his complex family currents. It's really a best of Hank Jr.
Country music singers have always been a real close family. But lately, some of my kin folks have disowned a few others than me. I guess it's because I kind of changed my direction. Lord, I guess I went and broke their family tradition. They get on me, want to know, Hank, why do you drink? Hank, why do you roll smoke? Why must you live out the songs that you wrote? Over and over, everybody made
one highlight of the exhibit is the savvy frankness of the video interviews, whether it's Junior's sister Lucretia or his son Shelton, who performs as Hank III. They don't sensationalize the emotional train wrecks they've seen and experienced, but if you listen, they don't sugarcoat them either, and you're struck by Hank III's strong potential as a performer, particularly since he looks and sings more like his grandfather than his father.
Thank you.
Another surprise was outside the museum, a rally by a small group of cultural activists who call themselves Reinstate Hank, and who want to reverse the injustice of 1952 when Williams was kicked out of the Grand Ole Opry for being a bag of demons. Their quest is a bit quixotic since the Opry doesn't offer membership to dead people, but their argument is sound. If the Williams image is good enough to exploit, he's good enough to belong to the establishment. Because finally, what the Family Tradition Show establishes is that Hank Williams has become the most famous brand name for hard living and hard country music.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. The Family Tradition exhibit runs at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum through December 2009. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, we remember our former colleague, Wayne Connor. This is Fresh Air. We've saved the end of today's show to remember our former colleague here at WHYY, Wayne Connor. He died of liver cancer last month at the age of 79. When I came to WHYY in 1975, Wayne was already a veteran here. The station devoted many hours to classical music programming then, and Wayne hosted Singer's World and Collector's Corner. He shared his rare recordings and his encyclopedic knowledge on our station for three decades. You may remember him. His programs were aired on many NPR stations. Although he was outstanding on the radio, broadcasting wasn't really his profession. He taught vocal literature and history at the Peabody Conservatory, the Curtis Institute of Music, and the Academy of Vocal Arts. He was revered as a voice teacher and mentored many singers. Wayne was a great singer, but many of us who knew him at WHYY never heard him sing. In fact, some of his colleagues here didn't even know he'd had a career as a singer. Knowing that I wanted to play something on Fresh Air, Wayne's friend and colleague from Peabody, Ernie Ligon, burned a CD of a couple of Wayne's commercially released tracks, as well as songs from some of his recitals. The fact that Wayne never played for us what you're about to hear is an example of how modest he was. What a beautiful voice he had. It reflected the kind of person he was. This was recorded in 1960 at the Marlboro Music Festival and was released by Columbia, now Sony Records. The song is from Brahms' Liebeslieder. Accompanying Wayne at the piano are Rudolf Serkin and Leon Fleischer.
Thank you.
That was Wayne Connor. He died last month. He will be greatly missed. Our thanks to Ernie Ligon for the recording. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Boldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, Jonathan Menjivar, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at FordFound.org. And from Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The film Get Smart opens next week. It's based on the popular 1960s TV show, which spoofed the secret agent genre. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Steve Carell, who stars as secret agent Maxwell Smart. Carell also stars in the TV series The Office. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.